it's 4 minutes after 12 o'clock. Hey, great to have you tuned in today. I mean, of all days, this penultimate day of October. It's a Thursday, and do you recall that on Thursdays we have, well, the last Thursday of the month, we have Matt McAuliffe and Chris White in the studio, and they're here to enlighten us about various people that have influenced our lives as Christians, Christian history, and it seems like forever. It's really only been,
30 days.
Well, Matt was here by himself last time. He did yeoman work. Great
Absolutely.
Job there.
While Chris was gallivanting off in the Mediterranean.
Doing research.
Oh,
touring
sure.
Florence
yes.
and the Vatican.
Doing research for this very program.
Absolutely.
Got a little sack of tiles with him right there. That keeps, he pulled off the front of St. Mark's or something. But anyway, good to have you guys back, and I'm glad that we're going to look at these fellows who probably most folks don't know about, Cappadocian Fathers.
Cappadocian Fathers. Matt, take it away. Tell us about Cappadocia.
Well, we had Cappadocian this morning at the coffee shop.
How about cinnamon on top of
$2.95, isn't
absolutely,
it? You can get a
absolutely.
Okay, big one.
Cappadocia, let's be real. What we've got here are three guys that are fairly important, but that you will struggle to find material on. They're pretty critical, and we're going to take a look at them. First, let's talk about Cappadocia.
Okay.
Where the heck is it and what is it? It's a little part of Turkey, what we know today as Turkey. If you're looking at a map of Turkey, it's towards the east, a little bit on the right-hand side, right above Tarsus and Antioch, the corner of the Mediterranean Sea. And it's a pretty pretty pivotal. It became a Roman province, when the Romans were running around. And because of its location, it's right in the crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
It sits above Tarsus, separated by what are called the Cilician Gates. It's a pass through the really high Tarsus Mountains. And as a result, the Silk Road to China runs through there. The trade routes to the Middle East run through there. The Crusades came wandering through there. Almost anybody in that area, sooner or later, has to pass through that pass. And Cappadocia sits right on top of it. So it was an important place to be, and actually became a rather heavily developed area under Roman administration. Caesarea was its capital, a big, big city, one of the biggest, as a matter of fact. And, gosh, by the 4th century, what are we looking at, the 4th century? The Christian church has been underground and illegal and persecuted for 300 mm-hmm. years, and all of a sudden, Emperor Constantine comes to the throne, declares it legal, it's okay. Everybody's running around. Now they've got fish on their business cards and little stickers of the fish on the back of their chariots and running around. And anybody who's anybody is now a Christian. And this creates a certain amount of flux and discontent. We've talked about the Desert Fathers before going off in reaction to all this commonizing, if you will, of the religion.
Well, it was legal, and then it was official, right, with Theodosius.
You couldn't get contracts. Yeah, you couldn't. If you weren't a Christian, then pretty much you were... at the end of the line there in the Byzantine Empire. Well, it's interesting because Constantine did move the capital from Rome to what later became known as Constantinople, mm-hmm. right there up in the Bosphorus. And this was the beginning of what we see as the east-west split between the churches, not only the physical Roman Empire, but the church itself into the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And it was also an extremely important period of time because up till now, Christians have just been... trying to stay alive.
Right.
They really didn't have time to have seminars on how many angels could dance on the head of a pin, but now it's time to really decide and define what do we believe. Gosh, what do we really think about Jesus? What about the Trinity? What is the nature of God? Because many heresies were beginning to surface and were challenging the common understanding of our relationship with Christ. So it was really kind of an unsettled period, a lot going on at this period.
A lot of different teaching and had to figure out, what's really the truth?
Absolutely. And one of the things that is definitely true of the time period we're talking about, of course, the 4th century, is that that is a time, not the normalizing of Christianity, but also a time of the formulation of doctrine. Why did they all think this was a great idea? We ought to sit down and put down on paper what we believe. Well, no, there was actually an occasion for doing that. The occasion for doing that was there were a lot of differing beliefs going around and different teachings that didn't seem to line up with the Bible. And, of course, one of the ones that the Cappadocian Fathers came into was a teaching known as Arianism. Mm-hmm. And if you would, if we want to think about what is the significance of the Cappadocian Fathers for us today, why are they important? Why are we talking about them today? If we could sum that up in one word, it would be the idea of the doctrine of the Trinity or the triunity of God. And that was really these men's great contribution during their lifetime and their ministry. And Arianism basically taught a doctrine that Christ was not actually fully God, but that he was a creation of God, and that the Holy Spirit was also not fully God, but was a force or power of God, very similar to the doctrine promulgated by some of the cult groups today. And this was in vogue and popular and had been shut down before these men began their ministries, but had gone underground and had become a very popular thing within the Christian church. And so this became a long-standing battle, really, for that entire century. And these three men, Basil the Great, Gregory Nazianzus, and Gregory of Nyssa, all of them had a role, really, in putting the doctrine that we all use today of the Trinity into writing and developing that whole system of belief.
So what you're saying, Christopher, is that the Cappadocian Fathers are the reason that we are not all Jehovah's Witnesses today.
Pretty much in a nutshell, yeah. That would
that
be
works for me.
If we could really bring it down, that's what these three men were. But really, we want to talk about each of these men because they all made a they were very different people. Actually, Basil the Great, not to be confused with Basil, which is great for pesto.
The inventor of pesto.
The inventor of pesto. Basil the Great and Gregory of Nyssa were actually brothers. They were actually blood brothers. And then Gregory of Nazianzus was their buddy, one of their buddies. And so these were three men that were born within just a couple years of each other, died within a couple of years, and served within a couple miles of each other, really, as far as the crow flies, I guess. And we want to talk about each of these men and their unique contributions to the church.
And what we need to picture here is this whole thing with Arius, what started with Arius fighting against Athanasius at the Council of Nicaea, which is the famous thing
Creed.
Yes, we've all heard of that. But what we need to remember is this was a long conflict. This was, if I had to draw a modern parallel, I would say it's kind of like the Enlightenment thinking and postmodernism of today. I mean, it started 100 years ago, 150 years ago. We're still fighting it today. Arianism was like that. It was just simply something that the responsible members of the church had to continuously defend against over a century, two centuries, even three centuries. Well, after the big opening hubbub between Athanasius and Arius, which, as Chris said, ended in favor of an orthodox belief in divinity, Arianism was still very strong. As a matter of fact, one of the missionaries, Ulfilas, that went up to do the barbarians, he did convert the barbarians, the Goths, and did good work up there, but they were Arian. And as a result, they had a lot of justification for remaining very violent, they still came down and destroyed Rome the next century. So there were good reasons to be careful about doctrine. Well, just for fun, let's picture in our minds, in central eastern Turkey, there is a very spiritual young woman named
Macrina.
And this is, about 350 A.D., and she has a great idea. She decides to get a bunch of gals together, and they're just going to live in a house and form a community based on and devoted to God and the works of God. Well, she's got two little brothers. Basically, she's got the first convent in human history going on here.
Okay.
And she's got two little brothers. One is a very successful college student, just got back. He's got a very promising career as an administrator, government official. And she talks her little brother, Basil, into becoming a monk. Well, by golly, that's what he does. I'd love to be there. It'd be fun to have more information on this, but we don't. We just know that she inspired him to turn from a secular career to monasticism. And he ran with that ball. He really pretty much was the forerunner of modern monasticism. He was kind of suspicious of the desert monks. There were good ones.
He went down there and he liked what he saw, and he liked to see the pursuit of God, but he found himself very, very suspicious of the rugged individualism of these guys.
And a lot of pride down there.
Okay.
You know,
and
some of the guys.
When he came back, he very much was committed to that idea, But he was committed to more of a community-ordered life and felt like that was very important. And actually was a influencer who really profoundly, of course, affected Western civilization, and that was Benedict of Nursia. And and so he was later influenced by Basil the Great.
Yeah, so here's Basil at 28 years old, founds his little monastery right very close to his sister Macrina's monastery on their family estate there in central Turkey. And he writes up his rule, which emphasized, charity to the poor, obedience to superiors.
And labor.
And labor, yes, which was an extremely important thing, because up to that point in human history, labor was looked down on. And this is kind of the awakening of the dignity of individual manual labor as an act of worship. Well, anyway, it's not a real big thing like the Rule of Benedict, but it is the first one. And as Chris said, Benedict used this later. He leaned on it heavily to develop his own rule. So here he is, 28 years old. He's got a monastery going. He's written this rule. Things are rocking. And he really feels called to champion the poor, who are basically ignored. So he develops what we believe are the first recorded instances of common hospitals. Shelters, kitchens. Within a few years, his little monastery has grown and has added so many buildings and is ministering to so many people that they've started to call it Neo Caesarea. And it is, in essence, a tiny reproduction, a new city all of its own. So very interesting. And he's gaining some fame as a result of this, and eventually is appointed bishop over Caesarea and starts to do a lot of reforming type things.
And this he does. He holds the role of bishop for about 40 years in his throughout his life. But he's also, in addition to the things that Matthew was talking about, he's also really known as a great theologian. He was a Bible interpreter and a preacher. And actually, one of the things that Basil did was he definitely moved into a very conservative form of biblical interpretation. He followed a pattern of literal biblical interpretation, and he is one of the people that we refer back to when we look at how should we today interpret God's Word. We look at it. He is one of the examples that we would follow. But he was also the theologian, if you'll remember this phrase, that God is one substance in three persons.
Mm-hmm.
That comes to us from Basil the Great. And he insisted on the oneness of God, but expressed in three different persons. And so this really becomes, if you will, the theological reverberation that we have even today from his short lifetime and ministry way back in the 4th century.
He's kind of a cranky old coot, too, wasn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Cranky,
well,
huh?
The other one of the Cappadocian fathers is who we know, of course, as Gregory Nazianzus. And he could actually be likened to, a college roommate. He was a school chum of Basil when they went to school in Athens. He actually went to school in all sorts of different places. He had studied and all that. Another person he went to school with was the future emperor of the Roman Empire, Julian the Apostate. They actually spent time in school together.
Not high on our popular list.
Not high on the Christian top 10 of Roman emperors list. And actually, even at this time, he pointed out and wrote down that he felt like Julian was a real lowlife, even back when they... absolutely.
Guy?
He thought very, very little of him, even when they were going to school together. Well, Gregory joins Basil's monastery, and he, though, is really distinguished, if you will, as the theologian. He was a rhetorician. Mm-hmm. He was a speaker. He was learned.
This guy's a brainiac.
He's an absolute, a brainiac. Matter of fact, he was such a great preacher that at one point he is brought into Constantinople. And within a few years, through his preaching, he started out in a home, and pretty soon he is elevated to being the bishop of Constantinople.
Wow. He wasn't real happy about that, wasn't he?
He did not like that. And as a matter of fact, that's kind of an interesting thing, is the fact that he was, and this was a very common thing that two of these men went through, is what they called a ordination of violence. And what this means is that these people in no way really had any designs on becoming clergy, on becoming priests, on becoming bishops in any way, but they were actually forced into this position by circumstances against their will. They were forced either by the people on threat of violence, they were forced in by government officials, but this was absolutely the polar opposite of what these guys wanted to do.
Didn't Augustine and John Calvin too?
It's a very interesting phenomenon that some of the greatest people in the history of the church were actually had no desire whatsoever to become clergy. It wasn't like they had this heavenly vision that told them. They were actually literally forced by circumstances, and they called them, Gregory of Nazianzus called them, called it circumstances of tyranny that forced him actually to become a bishop.
He would have been much happier just reading, reflecting, meditating, writing his... Didn't he do poetry?
That's an interesting thing about him is the fact that he, most of his theological writing, his devotional writing, was all written in poetry. And
wow.
He was a lover of the great Greek classics. And,
sounds like another Jerome.
Well, in his lifetime, it's an interesting
thing. Jerome came to listen to him. He was
okay,
so impressed.
Yeah. He was ahead of Jerome.
He was ahead of Jerome. Jerome would have been probably a younger lad, maybe even a teenager at the time. But he was greatly influenced by the Greek classics and the long epic poetry and all that. And so he would write in poetic form. And actually, the body of literature that he left behind that still exists today, most of it is poetry. He even wrote his autobiography in the form of a long poem. And so it's an interesting phenomenon about that. But he was one of those people, once again, that here he was, very, very astute theologian, deep thinker, loved to read and write, hated administration, hated overseeing the church, and yet he is one of the pivotal figures. He actually presided over the Council of Constantinople in 381.
Now, isn't that the place where we pretty much drove the stake through the heart of Arianism?
Absolutely. Okay. And pretty much, if we want to talk about the Nicene Creed, which is the unifying creed of all Orthodox Christians in the world, this began at Nicaea in 325, but really what we have today is it was finished in 381 at the Council of Constantinople. And so he actually was the presider over that and worked in the formulation of some of the doctrines and some of that creed that we read even today in the church.
So there you go. In the back of your hymnal is the Gregory of Nazianzus.
And it is, you know, and actually practically it should be called the Nicaea Constantinople Creed, okay. Even though that's a mouthful, so we call it the Nicene Creed. But there was definitely a development that happened over time that culminated there. And that's really one of the great contributions of Gregory of Nazianzus, the second of the Cappadocian Fathers.
But he didn't act alone.
Absolutely not.
I got a good guy here. Basil had a little brother,
okay,
and who we're going to call Gregory of Nyssa because eventually he was appointed bishop of Nyssa, and that's just 50 miles from Caesarea. This all happened. These guys all pretty much worked within 50 miles of each other all their lives. But Gregory is the younger brother of Basil. Again, just like Gregory of Nazianzus, he was very unwilling. He wanted very much just to read, write, reflect, sit on the edge of the pond. I mean, who wouldn't? I mean,
that's right.
These guys are our kind of guys.
He was actually a gardening addict. That was gardening was one of his chief pleasures in life.
Oh, I like it. But his big brother is now a very big wig in the church administration, and he needs people he can depend on. So he appoints people, specifically his brother, to be a bishop because he figures he can depend on him. Well, poor Gregory, he's more of a space cadet, mystical kind of guy. As a matter of fact, he is known as the father of Christian mysticism, mm-hmm. even though there are others who contributed to that. But he really loved the allegorical works of Origen and the real spacey stuff. I mean, he was kind of a cadet, if you get my meaning. He did not do well as an administrator or bishop and ended up, oh gosh, they accused him of embezzling.
All sorts of financial malfeasance. But why would you put a church mystic, Christian mystic, in charge of administrating anything like that?
And he was not even politically aware enough. He didn't know how to defend himself, so he just gave up in disgust. But did end up helping Gregory of Nazianzus at the Council of Constantinople, not only with his writings against heresy, but was in debate. He was a very capable speaker, very capable theologian, and ended up retiring to the family estates back there in central Turkey. And basically, we know of him today because of his extensive anti-heretical writings. And he's also the guy that wrote the biography that lets us know about his sister Macrina that got them both into this trip.
And that's probably something that we ought to always point out as well, is that so oftentimes, and of course Matthew and I have always tried to point out the contributions of the women in the body of Christ, but here's another example of how really behind these great men is a big sister pushing them along, and You know, that's how this world works, is a lot of times the influence. Matter of fact, you know, probably one of the main reasons that Greg of Nyssa got pushed into service was because his big brother probably couldn't find anybody else to do the job, so he forced his little brother to do it.
Now, your big brother's out there, and he needs your help. I don't want you hanging out here in the kitchen anymore. You go outside and play.
Sorry, well, I had to do that.
I know you had to do it.
Well, what are we looking at in terms of a conclusion? Why are these guys so important to us? Well, first of all, you can remember them by saying, okay, well, we got three Cappadocian fathers who are really important in establishing the Trinity. Mm-hmm. So you have the
three
Cappadocian
fathers
and the three persons of God. And they are really primarily the ones that formalized and codified that theology. They're the ones that handed it off within a few years to John Chrysostom and St. Augustine, because those guys just took what the Cappadocian fathers had formulated and they ran with it. And that pretty much set us in a set pattern of theological interpretation.
So, Matt, are you basically saying that we're always riding on the shoulders of greater men than ourselves?
Almost as if the fruit were a cumulative effect of the entire body of Christ.
That is amazing.
I'm stunned.
Well, and to this day, if you want to read about the Trinity, the most eloquent writings you'll find will be by those Cappadocian fathers. What an important doctrine it is, and I'm glad that you said that, you know, about Basil and the three expressions. One substance, but three expressions. That's probably the best way I've ever been able to interpret that.
Absolutely, and you know, we have to be so careful, because a lot of times people have the idea in their mind, well, you know, I don't need theology, I just need the Bible.
Hmm.
When in fact, that very statement is itself a theological statement. And it is so important, because if we say we just need the Bible, why do we just need the Bible? Why don't we need just the Bible and any other devotional book or whatever? That's because we believe in the inspiration of the Bible, that the Bible comes from God. That is a theological statement. Right theology is what really gives us hope. And when we don't have good theology, it leads to some very bad conclusions. It can lead to something even worse than having no hope, and that's having false hope. And so theology is an extremely important thing and an extremely important contribution.
Are you suggesting that where there's an abundance of counsel, the people have victory?
You know, one might even come to that conclusion or that assumption, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit, and before we get out of here, Pat, we have to remind everyone, these guys had problems. I mean, they were cranky. They argued. Gregory of Nazianzus gave up in disgust.
They're not people that Matthew would say, well, look at the fruit of their lives.
Oh, I would.
Look at the fruit. Malfeasance, sloth, laziness.
Abandonment.
Unwillingness to do God's will.
And yet, when it was time to stand up and be counted, when it really, really was in the midst of an important conflict, they all gave up their comfort and convenience and said, okay, this is what God needs me to do. I'll do it. And as a result, they pretty much, if they weren't the guys who built the foundation upon which this building rests, they were the guys that laid the first frames.
And who out there is listening today that possibly the Lord has been talking to you and trying to nudge you along in something he's called you to do, but perhaps you're too busy and you don't want to be inconvenienced by that.
It might be uncomfortable.
And yet God might be wanting to do something very, very great from you. And, you know, that might even be down to rocking the babies in the nursery at church this weekend. You don't know who you may hold, teaching the 5-year-old Sunday school class. You don't know who you might influence. You may influence somebody who's probably going to be one of the greats of this next century.
And good exhortation there. Yes, doing the work of the Lord even today. So that's those guys had no idea they were the Cappadocian fathers. They were just saying yes to God, even though it meant a sacrifice. And today you go to the Kremlin in Moscow, and you see Saint Basil, whatever.
Basil, I'm sure.
Okay, Basil. And that goes all the way back to that guy. And the eloquent preaching was, Gregory of Nazianzus, Gregory of Nyssa, and great writings there. And so thanks for doing that, fellas.
You bet. Hey, January 1st, that's the Feast of St. Basil. So fix some pesto on that day. And well, it is.
I'm with you, man. I'm not.
Okay.
I'm laughing with you.
Okay.
All right, guys, it's Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, and they're both on staff at Trail Christian Fellowship, and so if you have any angry letters, you would just pass them on.
Oh, God bless you, Patrick. You're a good
soul. Sure, we'll keep them and just have them here for you the next time you come in. And there will be a next time, and I think, is it the Persecuted
Church for November, absolutely.
All right, well, we'll look.